You are listening to The Bell Post.
Welcome to the 55th episode of The Bell Post. And today's guest is Jim Quinn, who is going to be able to talk to us about recidivism rates in New York and evaluating bail reform, which went into effect in 2020. Mr. Quinn, Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I like to research and look at people when I'm going to be when they're going to be a guest. And one of the things I noticed about you is you are four generations in New York. Tell me, what is the four generations of the Quinn family look like in New York?
Well, right now, I mean, it's my wife and I. We have four kids. We have five grandsons.
Wow, I'm very jealous of that. I hope my daughter's not listening.
I mean, I've lived here, obviously, all my life. I've lived in the city. My father grew up in Flatbush in Brooklyn. My mother grew up she loves to call it Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan, which is on the west side. And they moved to Queens in 1951, the year that I was born. And I've lived in Queens all my life, which is one of the counties of New York City.
You know, my family, the two sides of my family are very distinctly different. I mean, I've got one side that dates all the way back to the American Revolution. One of Benjamin Franklin's brothers is our great, 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 whatever grandfather. But we really consider that the crazy side of the family, the Franklins. The people that were the steadfast, the anchors of our family were really two or three generations back in the United States, came from Ireland, went through Ellis Island. My grandfather was the pedestal of our family. He was a deacon in his church. You didn't really say anything. I mean, he's a unique person. I've never met anybody about him like him since. You didn't say anything bad about anybody else in the family to him because you did not want him to think poorly of anyone in the family. And in a competitive family like we have, you know, that was very not very frequent. We have a tendency to tear each other down to build ourselves up. And so I find it interesting that y'all been back four generations. Where did y'all come from before y'all came to New York?
They go way back. They're in Ireland and, Cork County and Cavan County, Port German. It goes back to like 1860, 1870, that time. My brother actually searched it back a while. And he was trying to find somebody who had fought in the Civil War. That was his big thing, but he got somebody he thought might be, so he's still looking into that.
Well, I've had family and daughters of the American Revolution, and I've thought about applying for that for my daughter, but I'm like, I think I had a sister who attended those meetings, and it was mostly little old ladies, and my sister, and she's since passed away. But you know, we're here to talk today about bail reform that went into effect in 2020 in New York, and I think kind of to understand the changes that were made, we have to understand what was the criminal justice system like before the reforms went into effect in January of 2020. So kind of tell us, what was the criminal justice system like in New York before bail reform?
It was better than it is now. I can tell you that without any equivocation. The criminal justice system in New York is probably like most criminal justice systems around the country. It was slow. It was overwhelmed. But it did work. There was a lot of criticism back in 2019 that the criminal justice system was broken, that the criminal justice system was not fair, that it was racist, that it was systemically racist. None of which was really true. When you really look at the statistics and look at what it had done, the criminal justice system writ large, meaning the police department, the courts, the DA's offices, the defense bar, over the years from 1993 to 2018, had decreased crime in New York City by almost 80%. It had reduced the jail population in New York City by close to 60% in that time. It had sped up the processing of cases during that time. It had added numerous alternative sentencing programs, drug treatment programs. We had different courts, court system. We had a drug court. We had a mental health court, both misdemeanor and felony. We had a veterans court. We had anger management courts. We had community service that, that defendants were being sentenced to. And it was a combination of all of those things that resulted in crime being reduced, and the jail population being reduced. And it really, really got a bad name from a bunch of advocacy groups and ideological politicians continually trashing and trashing and trashing the system.
You know, I look at it as we were the victim of our own success. I mean, a lot of what I see happening today is really making the same mistakes we made in the 60s. We were very successful. Crime was going down. We felt more safe. So we were more forgiving, or we were willing to be more forgiving. We were more forgiving in our laws. We changed some of the laws. We had started seeing crime go up. People on one side of the spectrum fought and said, we're not going to change anything back. And so we started seeing a backlash. And then ultimately Reagan was a result of the backlash, the war on crime. And so it seems like we're in the middle of making the same, we're making the same mistakes and committing the same cycle that we had in the 60s.
That's a friend of mine always said that New York's criminal justice system was a victim of its own success. And you know, you could see, you know, as crime was going down, the progressive left in New York City and New York State was becoming louder and louder to try to change the system without any real analysis of what they were doing, what the effect was going to be of what they were planning. I worked at the time in 2019, I was an executive assistant DA in the Queens DA's office. And Queens County is a county of 2 million people, which is larger than most cities in the United States. And we had great statistical analyses. We had enormous data. We had data from the court system, from the prison system, from probation, from parole, from our own data that we were putting into our system. So we could look at the claims that these people were making. And every single one of them, we were able to completely debunk. And yet they continued to spout them. We were in contact with the mayor's office back then, Mayor de Blasio, and we would give him these statistics and tell them that, look, what these people are saying is not true. It's just not true. And it was really to no effect. You know, we couldn't convince.
A lot of the problems we're seeing in New York, we're only seeing the rest of the country in urban areas where they have DAs that are pushing these types of reforms. But New York is unique because we have a statewide reform that was passed. And so it's a lot larger scale. We're seeing the ramifications or the impacts of these policies, where in other areas, we're kind of seeing them adopted in an urban city in one place, another urban city. And so you may see some of the statewide statistics on crime, where the majority of the state is still following the tried and true methods that we're teaching in colleges of what works. You've addressed that there was really the push for reform sometimes were coming from advocacy groups and not from any real science. But how did these reforms that were ultimately passed in 2019, how did they come about? I mean, what was the push for them at the legislature? Or were they just kind of pushed in the middle of the night, nobody knew about them?
Well, it's a combination of both. New York State, for the longest time, you know, we were a bicameral state, so we had two legislatures. We have the state Senate and the state Assembly, and then the governor, of course. The state Assembly had been Democrat-controlled for forever, basically, since the 70s, I guess. The state Senate, on the other hand, had been Republican up until, say, 2013, 2014. And there were some moderate Democrats who voted along with the Republicans to kill a lot of this crazy legislation. But the legislation had been out there. It was being pushed by the Legal Aid Society, you know, various defender organizations, and a bunch of other very active progressive groups. So the legislature was there, but it never got through the state Senate. It was always passed by the Assembly, but never got to the state Senate. So nobody was really took it seriously at all. Then in 2018, the legislature The moderate Democrats were all defeated in Democratic primaries, and the Democrats now took control of the, they had control of the state Senate, state assembly. They took control of the state Senate. They had the governor, and the people who took control in the state Senate were the radical progressives, in New York. And so they, you know, put together these, all these crazy bills that never got anywhere in the past. And they were passed as part of the budget bill. York, you know, passes one gigantic bill that had all sorts of non-budgetary items in it. And one of them was bail reform and discovery reform. And they were all thrown into this, you know, $200 billion bill. And you either voted for that, or, you know, you didn't open the libraries next, the next week. And they were all passed on, you know, appropriately April Fool's Day of 2019, and took effect on January 1st of 2020. So it was, and really there were no hearings on these bills. There were no, there was just no real consideration of the effect of what these of
Well,
these
you know, when
bills.
I talk about New York, I'm like, the reforms that were pushed there were not science-based. They were not being pushed by any group that say, here's the science behind this, here's the way we're, I mean, it was all pushed by partisans or just put into a bill by partisans. And so there wasn't any science to back it up.
No, I mean, you know, and I know there was no science because I used to go to meetings about this stuff, and they would tell us how they were going to reduce the jail population in New York City in particular, by getting rid of by releasing all the defendants who were being held on turnstile jumping and small possession of small amounts of marijuana, and you know, all these other minor crimes. And I would go back to my office and I'd go to our statistical people. And I'd say, I want to know how many people are currently incarcerated in Queen on Queens cases for turnstile jumping. And there were none. None. And how many people are being held solely on misdemeanor possession of marijuana? There were none. And any time that they came up with these crazy claims, you know, they at one point they claimed that they were going to reduce the population by releasing all the people being held for prostitution. And we looked at it, and there were none. I mean, it was ridiculous. But they kept repeating this stuff over and over again. And if you were to challenge them, you know, you were being called racist and mean-spirited, and you know, the usual stuff. And we would show them the data, and we'd ask them, "Show us where we're wrong." And they never did, and because they couldn't. And
You know, we
if
hear that in other parts of the country. You know, we've got people who are poor, first-time offenders who are languishing in jail. And I always say, no, there's not. I mean, that's a very good talking point. And you know, when you look at those talking points, you could argue, okay, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they're well-intentioned. I don't know if we can really say that today after all the pushes and things that we've tried and things that we know have not worked and they won't agree to it. But you look at this and you go, okay, maybe they're well-intentioned. But when you enact a policy that ties the hands of the judges in the name of protecting the poor or people charged with low-level crimes, you're also tying the judges' hands so they can't address gangs, career criminals, or organized crime. And when you do that and you don't and you're told that and you won't change it, then how can you conclude anything other than that was your intent all along?
to show you how ridiculous and how little thought actually went into the original 2019 reforms. Under the 2019 reforms, a judge could not set bail on a defendant charged with escape. Okay? Or bail jumping. Couldn't set bail. He had to release him without bail. And, you know, it's so ridiculous. And, you know, they simply did not, I don't like to question people's motives. I don't like to do that. I mean, I like to look at the statistics and the facts and put that in my argument. But it is very hard to think that these people had the best interests of New Yorkers when they passed these laws, simply because even when you show them that the data that they, you know, the data that they relied on was wrong, it's really the chance that they relied on are wrong. They refuse to accept it. And you hear in private, from some of the people from the mayor's office or the governor's office, that these legislators are telling them that they're willing to accept the rise in crime as a cost of getting rid of racism from the criminal justice system. And
Wow.
it's just pathetic. It really is.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment because, this whole concept of these reforms is based upon the assumption that we're getting rid of systemic racism. But, Minnesota has a report that they released recently where they track the people who are reporting crimes all the way through conviction. And the people that are reporting crimes against, a certain minority group are the same minority group. And so you look at that report and you conclude that they have a disproportionate amount of crime being committed by a certain racial group. And then as that group goes through the criminal justice system, their results actually improve versus other races. And so the report said, this is not the result of systemic racism because the group that you're saying that is subject to systemic racism, their result is improving once they're given the criminal justice system. And my point is, if our assumption is not correct, who are we harming the most? That very racial group, because they're committing crime in their same communities. And so the people who are getting hurt the worst is the people that the same racial group that they say that they are trying to help.
That's the thing that is so frustrating. The New York City Police Department, every year, and it goes back to at least 2008, it's been published on their website of the New York City Police Department, analyzes people who are victims of crime by race and breaks it down. People who are the victims of crime, the people who are the suspect in that crime, in other words, how the victim describes them.
Sure.
And people who are arrested for those crimes. And in New York City, 96% of the people who are shot in New York City are Black or Hispanic. 96%. They're 50% of the population, almost all of the shooting victims. 90% of the homicide victims in New York City are Black or Hispanic. And you could take that with every single crime in New York City, Blacks and Hispanics are disproportionately the victims of crime. Any crime. You can go down to misdemeanor assaults. You can go down to petty larcenies. You can go to grand larcenies. Any crime where the police can identify the race of the victim, they are disproportionately Black or Hispanic. And it's the same thing with the suspects, the people who are the
Sure,
victims are
because
described
we
as suspects.
commit crime on generally on the same racial group. So
Yes, and that's what's so frustrating about this, because they put it in terms of, that the criminal justice system is systemically racist. And first of all, I don't know what that means, especially when you're dealing in New York City. Our police department is now majority minority.
sure.
There are an awful lot of minority judges in the New York City criminal justice system. The DAs in New York City, two of the district attorneys in Manhattan and the Bronx are African American. The DA in Brooklyn is Hispanic, and it's just they continually make these claims which are just not true, and they are disprovable.
I've spoken to groups before, and I'm like, how can you ha say a system in a community is systemically racist when the arresting officer is the same minority group, where the judge is the same minority group, the prosecutor is the same minority group, and generally the jury is the same minority group? I mean, how can you call that system where there's a conviction, how can you say that that was a result of systemic racism? I don't think you can. I think that's just an argument, a smokescreen to say why we want to have a criminal justice reform. And the problem is when we're wrong on our assumption, we're hurting the very population that they say they want to assist or help.
The problem with these groups, I mean, just about any organization that includes in their title the Center for Justice, whether it's the Brennan Center for Justice or the so-and-so Center for Justice or the so-and-so Center for Equality and Equity, and they are advocacy groups. They are not research groups, but they consistently publish reports that are they're not rational, objective reports. They are designed to prove that what they believe is right and is correct. And you know, when you read some of these reports, I mean, I've critiqued a couple of them in articles just because it drives me crazy. And you know, they have an entire staff,
Sure.
you know, and they work months on these reports. And I can read through them, and anybody who reads the full report, not just the first two pages, the executive summary, but if you read through the 30 or 40 pages of the report, you see that what they're claiming is just not true. And the things that the statistics that they cite to are totally misrepresented. And it's just so infuriating, because that then becomes the talking point for all the progressive legislators in the state.
Absolutely.
They say, oh, well, only 1% of those defendants who are released on bail get rearrested for a violent crime while their case is pending. Well, yeah, that's a true fact, but you know, we're not looking at every person who gets arrested and get out on bail. We're looking at a small subset of that.
Sure. So the
Yeah.
bail reform passed on April 1st, 2019. It went
Yes.
into effect January 2020.
Yes.
And when I look at, and when I talk about the bail reform in New York, I'm like, you know, we compare it to what other states call it. Y'all call it something different. You know, you in Texas, we call it release on a personal bond. In New York, I mean, in California, be released on zero bail. In New York, it seems like the reform was we set up a whole new group or a long list of offenses where you just got released on no bail. So you got released without a bond. We don't have an equivalent to that in Texas. So I group all those together and just call all of those simple release. You get a simple release mechanism for a whole list of crimes. But if you were to describe the reforms, is that what it is? We just made a whole long list of crimes that the judge couldn't set bail. They had to release them without bond.
Yes. In fact, what they did was their mantra was that you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't be held in jail on a nonviolent offense. So what they did was they took all the violent felony offenses, almost all of them, and said that a judge can set bail on a violent felony offense. But he cannot set bail on a nonviolent felony offense or a misdemeanor. Didn't matter what the defendant's prior record was. Didn't matter, you know, whether they were from, you know, out of the country. Didn't matter immigration status. We're not allowed to consider all of those offenses. You couldn't set bail on. So what happened was, on January 1st, when the law took effect, every single person in New York City jails who's being held on a nonviolent felony offense was released. So the judges actually started releasing them earlier to comply with the law on January, to be able to comply with the law on January 1st, and also so that you don't have 2,000 people walking out of New York City jails in one day. So what happened, every single person, everybody charged with a drug offense in New York City jails awaiting trial was released. Everybody charged with home burglary, residential burglary, was released. Everybody charged with the car theft was released. Everybody charged with any misdemeanor, petty larceny, misdemeanor assault, was released. Released. And what happened was you have 2,000 career criminals being released from jail. And you know, we had actually, when I was in the office, I asked our people to run some statistics and tell me, give me a profile of the people who are being held on Rikers Island awaiting trial. And when we did that, we found that in Queens County alone, there were about 400 of them awaiting trial, being held solely on bail. I'm not talking about people who were there because they
Sure.
violated parole or probation or anything like that. The only thing holding them in was that they could not post bail. There were 400 of them. Those people had an average of 5.7 felony arrests, prior felony arrests. It was 1.2 felony convictions, 4.7 misdemeanor arrests, 5.1 misdemeanor convictions, and two prior failures to appear. And all of those people were released. So what do you think they're going to do? They were released with basically no conditions. And if there were conditions and they violated the conditions, a judge still could not put them in jail because it was a non-bailable offense. So, all those people were out there. And what happened was, you can see the crime rate in New York City, starting in January of 2019. Crime was going down in January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August. Then it started going down slower in September, October, November, and December. As these people are being released, the crime rate is going down a lot slower than it was earlier in the year before they were released. In January 1st of 2020, these 2,000 people are released, and within 2.5 months, crime in New York City went up 20%, after having gone down almost every year since 1993. All of a sudden, it goes up 20%.
So if this was an offense that was on the no bail offense under the reform, the judge doesn't have the authority to set bail. Is it, I mean, I call these, charge-based release decisions. It's, it doesn't matter how many times you commit that charge, as long as it's on that list, the judge has to release them with no bond, cannot require bail. Is
Right.
that correct?
That was the original bail report that they set. And, like I said, I mean, one of the and I don't think they really, I'm sure that they didn't know what they were voting for. I mean, it took
Yeah,
us
absolutely.
weeks to figure this out, reading through it and all the different things. And you read it and you think that can't possibly be right. And then you start talking to people, and then it turns out that was right. A judge couldn't set bail on somebody who walked into your home and burglarized your home. Couldn't set bail. So
Had to
that
immediately release them without bail. I mean, I'm
yeah.
trying to say it in a way. I mean, in Texas, we'd say they can't release them on bail, and that's the only way you can be released. So you think they would hold them, but that means they were released.
They were
And
released. Everybody.
did the bail reform statute have anything like the New Jersey plan, a statewide pretrial services department, any additional money for monitoring, anything like that?
It did. It required what are called pretrial services to they have something called supervised release or non-monetary release, which means that when a defendant is released, if a judge finds that there's a risk that that guy will not show up, the judge can set conditions on the release. They have to be non-monetary. He can't set bail, but he can set non-monetary conditions. He can say, okay, you have to make a diligent effort to find a job, or you have to stay away from these people, or you have to do this, or you have to do that. But the problem was that if the defendant didn't do those things, there was nothing the judge could do except to impose more conditions.
Yeah,
And
no
if
accountability for the violation.
none, he couldn't remand him, which is what they used to be able to do if he violated the judge's conditions, because that offense is a release offense, to use your language, it's a release offense. He cannot set bail on him at all. He has to release him. So what happened was that a lot of the alternative sentencing programs
Yes.
started losing
Yeah,
people.
absolutely. Those you see drug courts going away in those situations.
Yes, the drug courts went
DWI
away.
courts going away.
We had a human trafficking court in Queens, and it was, every prostitution case went into the human trafficking court, everyone. And back in 2019, we had about 400 cases in the human trafficking court. And, all those women got counseling, they got, all sorts of treatment. They were trying to find them jobs and make sure that they were not being abused and all sorts of things. 400. Now, I think there are about 20, because the police are not making those arrests anymore. So those people are not being brought through the system. And if they're being brought into the system, there is no way that a judge is going to set bail on them. So these women are being, just completely put back out on the street, and left to their own devices. And, I mean, how do you justify that? If they're telling everybody for years and years and years that we that these women are victims. They're not defendants. They're victims of human trafficking. And now you take away any kind of support for them and rely on them to come in voluntarily, which is not going to happen. You
Well, I
know,
mean,
every
one of the basis of this reform initially was, hey, everybody wants to go to court. Everybody wants to resolve their cases. And I think, these reforms that were attempted during COVID just showed absolutely that that was not gonna, that's not true. But I mean, people see these types of changes where it's a charge-based release mechanism. They see that as a green light to commit more crime. But what was the impact on appearance rates? I mean, people who were charged and told to come to court, but there was no consequences if they didn't. What impact did that have on the courts?
And that's hard to judge because one of the other things that they did in the bail reform was that if a defendant was charged with a misdemeanor or a nonviolent felony, a police officer couldn't make an arrest of that individual. They had to issue them what's called a desk appearance ticket,
Yes,
which is
sir.
like a summons. And it's all right here. You have to appear in court on this date, which will be 3 weeks later. All right. If the defendant doesn't show up in those 3 weeks, it doesn't show up in the court statistics as a bench warrant being issued and a failure to appear because they only take their statistics after the defendant has been arraigned in court. So until the defendant appears in court on that desk appearance ticket, he's not arraigned, so it doesn't appear in the court statistics on appearance rates, which under the old law, the defendant would be arrested and brought directly to court
Sure.
and arraigned. So what happens is that on a lot of misdemeanor cases, if you look at defendants, say, charged with shoplifting, who have a prior record, who are given a desk appearance ticket, 40% of them don't even show up. And so but they're not counted in the failure to appear statistics. So they juggle this stuff and play around with it. And now with all the other reforms that they passed, the discovery reforms, our dismissal rates on felony cases have gone through the roof. The discovery stuff is impossible to comply with. So there really is, there's no downside to appearing in court anymore.
When Harris County tried similar reforms, their failure to appear rate just went through the roof. The DA did a report saying that they've increased at least 50%. And then the local police union did a report for just reviewing 1 week's docket of 8,000 cases, said no, it's over 70%. And then someone downloaded 2 years worth of data and put it on a website called harriscountycourtwatch.com and found that the failure to appear rate at, on average was over 80%. Now, I mean, that's just a mind-numbing number. And you go, that can't be accurate. You can't be true. I did a podcast with the DA from California, and he's like, that's the failure to appear rate across the state of California for misdemeanors, 80%. Because after they fail to appear, you can't get them to come back. It's a misdemeanor. You can't force them. You can't go get them. They have to do it willingly. And so it seems like we, these reforms are setting up, like kind of like you mentioned, they're setting up for failure. And so that's kind of the goal is to increase dismissals. I mean, I looked at a report in Harris County for 1 month for all the case resolutions for misdemeanor court, and over 90% were just dismissals.
Well, I mean, what's happening in New York, I mean, I just mentioned before about the discovery statutes. Prosecutors are required to turn over every single piece of discovery material, every police report, every witness's dates of birth, and criminal records, and everything, witness lists, everything within 20 days of arraignment. Now, it's impossible to do. And in New York City, police officers wear body-worn cameras. So you have to turn over every body-worn camera. And, we calculated it one time. The body-worn cameras average about 20, 25 minutes each. So you're not going to turn that over until you, the ADA, have reviewed it to make sure that it's not giving witnesses addresses or anything like that. And if it does, you have to redact it. And you have generally on even a misdemeanor case, you'll have three or four police officers show up at the scene. And they all have to turn on their body-worn cameras once they walk in. So you have to review every one of those body-worn cameras and then get it redacted and then duplicated and given to the defense bar within 20 days. That's on a misdemeanor case. And some of the ADAs in criminal court were handling 200 cases each, pending cases. And it's an impossible burden to comply with. And so what happened was the dismissal rate down in criminal court is up in those numbers. It's 60, 70% of cases being dismissed. And because we also have a speedy trial law in New York, the case on the misdemeanor case has to be brought to trial within 90 days. And if it's not, the case gets dismissed. And you can't answer ready for trial until you've complied with all your discovery obligations.
Wow.
And you have to file a certificate with the court saying that you've complied with all the discovery obligations before you can answer ready for trial. So you know, the ADAs, I don't know if I have everything yet. The cop won't give me this, or I need this report, so I can't comply, so I can't certify. So therefore, the cases are being dismissed because it's just overwhelming. It's turning over paperwork that nobody even reads.
Mm-hmm. I thought when they originally enacted the body cam requirement and that kind of swept the country, I said, you know, the problem with that is not the actual taking of the video. It's going to be the administration of it, the keeping of it, the producing it, and able to do that in an intelligent way and in a timely way. And it looks like that's really turned out to be a humongous problem. It's not the fact that we took it. It's the fact that how do we organize it? How do we maintain it? And how do we get it released in, like you said, redacted fashion?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. When they first talked about the body-worn cameras, you know, police departments everywhere and DAs are saying, oh, it's ridiculous. It's going to clog everything up and blah, blah, blah. We found that it was actually, it benefited the cops.
Sure.
It benefited the cases. It was actually a boon to law enforcement. And it was the administrative managing of this stuff and making sure that we got all of them, that we were able to send it over to the defense bar in a timely fashion. But under the old law, before they changed the discovery law, most misdemeanor cases were pled out on the first or second time on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you never had to comply with everything. You know, under the old law, you had to turn this stuff over before you went to trial, you know, when you were starting to pick a jury.
Sure.
So most of this stuff you didn't have to do. Now you have to do it on every single case. And the defense bar is not stupid. They know not to take a plea on the first or second time on down in criminal court because those cases are ultimately going to wind up being dismissed if the DA can get all of this stuff together. And Manhattan DA's office, you know, curiously did a study on, you know, all their discovery was done electronically. And when it was done electronically, they can look and see who was opening the material that was sent to the defense bar.
Sure.
And they found that 60 to 70% of the defense attorneys didn't even open the discovery material that was given to them because they know the case is going to plead out or it's going to be dismissed, you know? So, you know, it's like a time game, you know, it's just, you know, it has really nothing to do with justice or, you know, doing the right thing on these cases. It's all a game of, I'm going to wait you out. You're not going to be able to answer ready for trial. You're not going to be able to give me all of this stuff. If you do give me all this stuff, well, then I'll take the plea that I could have had, you know, the first
yes.
time on criminal court. And I don't lose anything. And I have a 50% chance that the case will be dismissed.
Well, so bail reform went into effect January of 2020, and immediately crime went up. And it seems like, you know, I've heard people say we should thank New York for saving, you know, bad bail reform across the country because it stopped it essentially. But so there was a backlash even in New York, but, and so there's been some rollbacks of the bail reform, but, you know, I've kind of vacillated between, okay, it's a substantive rollback. We've kind of made a few more crimes bailable, but it, I mean, how would you describe the three or four rollbacks of the bail reform statute?
They've been effective in a very small way because they're designed to apply to just a minimal set of cases. You know, if a defendant gets arrested and he has a pending case, a judge can set bail. But not if he's got, not if he's got a humongous record. You know, he could have one pending case and a judge may be able to set bail. But if he has no pending cases and a record of 30 or 40 prior arrests, a judge still can't set bail on that defendant.
What is this concept that the trial court cannot take into consideration the dangerousness of the defendant? Is I've heard that stated about New York.
Yeah, well, that's been historic in New York.
Has it?
But you know, that being said, a judge, you know, it a judge is not allowed under the criminal procedure law to consider the defendant's risk of reoffending or danger to the community when he sets bail. And that's been that way in New York since the 70s. But under the old law, judges would consider that under the guise of he's not going to come back into court. I don't believe that this individual is going to come back into court because he's got all these prior cases and he's facing, you know, umpteen years in jail based upon his prior record. A judge can't do that now if it's a non-bailable offense.
We used to be able to review their criminal history to make a determination for setting bail, but now we can't review it because they're a non-bailable offense. They just get released without bail.
Right, on non-bailable offenses. And it's, you know, it, like I said, the judges used to be able to do it in a, you know, without doing it, you know, without saying
Sure,
they're holding this
sure.
guy. They know that this guy is going to reoffend. And if he reoffends, he's not going to come back. Therefore, I'm not considering his dangerousness. I'm considering his failure, possible failure to appear because of his criminal record. And they can't do that.
Well, let's talk about recidivism rates as a result of the bail reform. It's, you know, I've seen, you know, the New York City comptroller says there's been 1% of the people released have been, you know, have been what we would call recidivated or, you know, considered that they were under the recidivism. The state Senate majority leader has said, well, that number's really just 2%. It seems like, you know, the numbers I've seen you quote are a lot higher. And so I really want to know how are they getting their numbers, and then what? How does law enforcement look at crime to determine the real recidivism rate, or what does science tell us the recidivism rate should consider?
I mean, I think that the easiest example that I can use for when you look at recidivism rates is if you look at the COVID death rate in the United States. All right,
Sure.
say 1 million people died of COVID, and there are 330 million people in the United States. So the death rate in the United States is one out of 330 million people. Okay, now that's true. Okay, but not everybody got COVID. So say only half the people got COVID. So there's 165 million people and a million died. So now the death rate is one out of 165 million. But now, not everybody who got COVID is in danger of dying. Some people are more in danger of dying from COVID. Like if you're over 70 and you got COVID, the death rate goes up to you know, as much as 50%. So if you look at those statistics and you look at recidivism rates, if you look at recidivism rates of everybody in New York State who gets arrested and then gets rearrested, it's going to be lower than people who have a prior criminal record and a prior criminal history. They are going to have a higher recidivism rate. And we know that. And those numbers that the comptroller and the state Senate majority leader quote, it's not 1% of everybody in New York who gets arrested gets rearrested. When you look at the qualifiers that they put on that, it's 1% of the people arrested and let out on bail get rearrested for a violent felony offense while their case is pending. Okay, that's while they're on bail. 1% of them get rearrested for a violent felony offense. When you look at the people with a criminal record who are released on bail, the recidivism rate for those people, while their case is pending, can go up as high as 70%, depending on the charge. But the average is 43%. So 43% of the people who have a prior felony, a prior arrest, in New York State, get rearrested while their case is pending. It's, you know, the numbers that they quote, you know, the people who would be put in jail, who would, under the old law, who would have had bail set, have a prior criminal record, or they are at risk of flight, one of those two. And that group, people who are have a prior record and are at risk of flight, who get released on no bail, 43% of them get rearrested. And if they're charged with shoplifting, 70% of them get rearrested. If they're charged with burglary, it's up in the 60s. You know, you can look at a defendant and you know that this guy is going to get rearrested. You know that.
We had the same statistical fight in Harris County, where you know the people supporting reform were saying you know the same thing as the comptroller, same as majority leader of the Senate, and then we have the DA who is a Democrat DA saying no, it's much higher. And I think the first thing I ever saw of you was talking about the difference of those two calculations, and I thought you know that explains exactly how two different groups can come to completely different numbers. And it looks like one is a, you know, used car salesman trying to sell you on the reforms they made. And they keep saying the same thing. Well, they're not working, but we need more time. We need more time. We need more time. And then we have the people within the criminal justice system, the people with the science, the saying, here's what we look at as in the criminal justice system on criminals and recidivism rates. And we're, you know, the other group is completely ignoring that and saying, oh, believe me, don't believe your what law enforcement's telling you. And it seems that we're seeing that across the country. Don't believe law enforcement, believe us. We don't have any science to support it, but believe us and don't believe law enforcement. That seems like we're in a crazy period.
Well, I mean, they come up with catchy phrases like, you know, we're criminalizing poverty, you know. I mean, and those sort of things, and ending systemic racism. I mean, it sounds grand, you know. You sound like such a wonderful person having to do away with racism, and I don't want to lock somebody up because they stole a loaf of bread. Well, yeah, that doesn't happen. I mean, it really doesn't. And you know, the people at bail set are the people who are a danger to the community, and you know, that's a fact. You know, but they created this myth that everybody who gets arrested for any crime automatically has bail set and is held in jail until their trial. And it's just not true. And but they can't come back on that because it would blow up their entire theory of the criminal justice system.
Well, let's talk about an article that you wrote in March of this year talking about a DCJ study, a data collection for justice study. But what was the DCJ study and why did you write an article about it?
The DCJ is a unit out of John Jay College for Criminal Justice, and they do analyses of the bail reform laws. And every analysis that they do says that the bail reform laws are wonderful, that the recidivism rate is low, that you know, and all these other things. And you know, again, they'll do it in a 30 or 40 page report. And their executive summary will have, you know, oh, it's great. It has reduced recidivism in New York State, which is one of the reports that they did a while ago. And I wrote on that also. But they misrepresent everything in these reports. Their report, when you read through it, you find out that, like in little snippets, that people with a violent criminal history or a pending violent case are more likely to reoffend than people without a prior criminal record or prior pending case. And I mean, to me, that should be the headline because that confirms everything that prosecutors and police officers have been saying about bail and about bail reform. And what they found in one of this last study that I wrote about, they found that 66% of the people who were arrested and let out on bail who have a prior record get rearrested within 2 years. Two out of three. And, you know, that's a rearrest rate. That's not a reoffend rate because People who have a history of criminal activity don't stop, automatically, and they don't get arrested for every crime that they commit. All you have to do is look at the clearance rates in New York City. I mean, car theft, the clearance rate is 14%, which means that, what is it, 7 out of 8 of them get away and never get rearrested, never get arrested for it. So, it's frustrating, but like I was saying before, the Data Collaborative for Justice has an entire unit of multiple people working on this. They have data that they can massage that they get from the court system. That's not available to everybody, unless you're like one of these special groups looking into the data. And I don't want to say, I hate to use the words misrepresent, but they know what they're doing. And I have been dealing with them for years. I dealt with these people when they were in the mayor's office pushing bail reform in the first place. And now they're working for the Data Collaborative for Justice, printing reports that justify the bail reform measures that they proposed and got passed. So, it's frustrating.
It seems like we have, I mean, with the data we're talking about, it seems like on recidivism, we have this subpopulation of New York City of people that are career criminals. And those are people who are being arrested and rearrested. And we know who they are. I mean, police can identify them because they're continue to be arrested. But we've set up a system that is almost giving them a green light to commit more crime. I mean, why be surprised that crime is going up? We're continuing to rearrest them. We're not doing anything to deter them. We've taken away all powers for the judges to hold them as long as they stay within certain number of crimes. And that's where I keep saying organized crime gangs and career criminals have found a way to make a killing off of the system on those types of crimes.
You're right. it's. I mean, any police agency or any prosecutor's agency across the country will tell you the same thing. I mean, New York City, I forget the exact numbers, but I think it was at 347 people were arrested in connection with 30% of the petty larcenies in New York City in 1 year. Those 347 people were in jail. I'm not saying they would all be in jail, but if those 347 people were in jail, petty larcenies would have been reduced by 30% in New York City.
Well,
A
and as a
year.
result, we have now today people, politicians talking out of both sides of their mouth. Crime is going down, but we're putting the National Guard in the subways to protect people from being pushed off into in front of trains. But believe us, crime is going down.
Well, that's interesting because, I last night in preparation for this, I just went and looked at some numbers. And, again, the New York City Police Department has an enormous amount of data on their website. And you can look up the crime statistics. They publish it every week. They come up with a report telling you where crime is in New York City. And crime in 2024 is down something like 3% from 2023. But it's up 40% since 2019. So, and you can track crime in, I mean, pretty much all across the country by the population of the city jails. In 2020, when they released the 2,000 people from jail under the bail reform, in the first 2.5 months, crime went up about 20%, but it went up in every crime category under which people were released. Went up, petty larceny, it went up in burglary, it went up in robbery, it went up in grand larceny, and that was in the first 2.5 months. Then COVID hit, and this was all before COVID, so you can't blame any of that on COVID. When COVID hit, the city went into panic mode and started reducing another 2,000 people from city jails under COVID. And these people were the more dangerous ones who were still being held on bail under the new bail laws. And when that started, then you started seeing the shootings and the homicides start going through the roof. And by the end of 2021, shootings in New York City had doubled from where they were in 2019. And then, as the COVID crisis started abating, the population in city jails started going back up. And you know, pre-bail reform, there were about 8,000 in city jails. Post-bail reform, there were 6,000. In the middle of COVID, there were 4,000. Now they're back up to about 6,200, and crime is stabilizing, but it's stabilizing at a level that's 40% higher than it was before bail reform. And they're calling this a success. And you know, when you do that, you're talking about another 40,000 people being victims of crime every year. And that's okay, because it's not as bad as it was last year. It's 3% lower than last year. And you know, that's one of the things that is so frustrating to me. I mean, I'm retired from the DA's office. I've been retired for 4 years, and I still write about this stuff because it's the only way I can keep my sanity, is what I tell people. Because you know, to see what's going on and hearing what they're saying, it just absolutely drives me crazy. And
Well, one of the things I want to touch on before we move on is, you know, what's the status of Rikers Island, the jail there? Because there's been some discussion about closing it, building some regional facilities, but I mean, it looks like to me, based on what we're seeing in other parts of the country, is one of the ways they're pushing for release is by reducing their capacity for their jail and refusing to build additional capacity, and then that pushes policymakers to come up with policies to reduce more people from jail, even if they increase crime.
well, this is kind of like Niagara Falls for me, because this is where I got started in this stuff. When New York City was started talking about closing Rikers and building community jails, you know, when they started talking about this, the population in Rikers was about 10,000, and they wanted to get it down to 5,000 so that they could close Rikers and build jails, community jails. They're going to build four jails, each with a population of about 1,300, and they were going to close Rikers. They still haven't said what they're going to do with Rikers Island. You know, they were just going to close everything down and build these jails in the four communities. And originally, they were going to have about, I think, 5,500 jail cells built in these four community jails, one in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens. They got so much opposition from the community over the 5,500 jail cells that they then reduced the size to 3,300 solely because of criminal opposition. Because you know, the jails are going to be 40 stories high, you know, in neighborhoods where the you know, where there aren't that many buildings that are 40 stories high. So, and it was going to cost $30 billion over 30 years, and so they reduced it then to 3,300. Now, right now, there are 6,200 people in city jails. And they're people who are being held under the current progressive liberal bail reform laws. So they have to reduce it by another 2,900 people and then cap it at that forever. It is insanity. And, you know, they're having all kinds of problems building these jails and finding the money for them and working out the details of them, because the way that they've built these jails, they are still going to be 20 to 30 stories high. And most jails around the country are built no more than 3 or 4 stories high, because it's the preferred way to build a jail. Rikers Island has acres and acres of vacant land where they could have built these jails years and years ago and made them the utmost world class, done everything, you know, perfect. But they refused to do that. For no other reason than that people are, oh, Rikers, we can't have to close Rikers because of it's a stain on our city. You know, it's a, you know, torture island, they call it. And, you know, the notorious Rikers Island. So we can't even build new jails on Rikers Island. So they come up with this other plan, which is, you know, it's not going to be done for another couple of years. They have not put a lot of money into fixing up Rikers Island. So now there's a federal monitor who may wind up taking over the entire jail system in New York City. And that is going to be a disaster.
Oh,
An
it's
app.
not only going to be a disaster, it's a plan, I think, to order the cap the number of people that can be in the jail, which will then reduce population further and tie the hands of law enforcement, tie the hands of judges, and push them to further enact policies to just release, simple release.
I remember going to a meeting with Mayor de Blasio, came over to see the DA, who DA Richard Brown was the DA back then. He had 50 years, in the criminal justice system, in the court system. And de Blasio was talking about closing Rikers, and DA Brown was opposed to it. He said, you can't do that. Why not just rebuild better facilities on Rikers? And de Blasio said that, no, we think we can get the population down to, we think we can get it safely down to 6,000, is what he said.
We think
And
we can safely get it down. It's not based on any science. It's not based on any recommendations from the criminal justice system. It's not anything recommendations from you, the DA. It's just on our policy supporters.
And like 2 months later, he reduced the number to 3,300 from 6,000.
Wow.
With and you know the his you know there there's also a group trying to get the number reduced to 2,200. That's a city of 8.6 million people. What the heck are we talking about here? Having a jail with 3,300 people in it for the
Wow.
entire city of New York?
Well,
It's
I
just not.
remember with the last round of rollbacks that the governor said, okay, we're done. We're not going to roll back any further. This is sufficient. We're going to get rid of the least restrictive means requirement, and we're now done with rolling back bail reform. And it seems like crime has, either if you could say there are areas where it still continue to go up, you can say it's statistically the same, whatever, it's still increased since 2019. What does the future hold for New York and its bail reform movement?
That's the hardest thing to deal with. I keep publishing things and writing things showing how it's failing, and it's dangerous to New York City. Getting it changed is almost impossible. You need a governor. I mean, they lost two DA spots because of bail reform. They lost Nassau County and Suffolk County, which are million person counties out on Long Island, flipped from Democrat DAs to Republican DAs, basically over bail reform. And it didn't affect the legislators at all. They don't care. The assembly is now 100 to 50 Democrat to Republican. To get them to change these bail laws and allow judges to consider dangerousness, I don't see that happening. Unless you have a governor in there who's going to bang heads and veto everything that they bring to them and really fight them and go to the public about it. But it's not going to happen. I mean, Hochul got 53% of Governor Hochul got 53% of the vote in New York
Yeah,
to
but I look back at
47%.
that election. There were some, U.S. House seats that switched, and I thought, and I saw an article where Pelosi blamed New York and their criminal justice reform for the House switching from Democrat to Republican. So, when I look at these reforms, and when I speak on these issues across the country, I'm like, I'm hopeful. And but the reason why I'm hopeful is what is currently being done is not sustainable. I mean, we can't sustain the current trajectory for New York for criminal justice without having the collapse of the system. I would argue that we have people, that's what their goal is to collapse the system. But I quote the mayor of New York, who I saw on a podcast recently, and he was fighting with the far left. There was a person on the panel that was far left, and whatever he's doing, it's just not good enough for her. And she was attacking him that he's terrible. But he was the best point he made was, a foundation of a society is public safety. And if you can't provide public safety, then you won't have a society and we'll have a breakdown. And so, I mean, the public will demand public safety. If the government will not give it to them, it will get it itself. That's why you're seeing the DA in New York prosecute the do-gooders to try to depress to stop that from happening. But I'm hopeful because what we're where we're going is not sustainable.
It's sustainable if you don't care. If your only motive is to sound like you're the most virtuous person in the room and say, well, we're doing this to end racism. We're doing this to end people being locked up because they're poor. We're doing this to end the mean-spiritedness of the criminal justice system. And the numbers that you're talking about, they're really not true. There are other reasons for the rising. not bail reform.
Yeah, we just need more
Look
time.
at this report from the Data Collaborative for Justice. Yeah, right here. And they'll come up with all these other reports that are meaningless, but they are so invested in the success of this.
Well,
And
I think the biggest takeaway from today is the comment you made where people in the legislature are saying they're willing to put up with more crime to change the criminal justice system. And that's the whole purpose of the criminal justice system is to address crime. And without it, or if you change the purpose, then we have nothing but chaos. That's what they're creating in our criminal justice system, and that's what we have to point out, and that's what we have to show.
They have to accept that there are bad people in the world, and that not everybody who commits a crime is doing it as a result of oppression or discrimination or failed opportunities or the system beating them down. There are people who are bad, and they have to be held accountable for it. And they refuse to accept that. And, you know, it's how do you get away with saying that the criminal justice system was broken when it reduced crime by 85% and
Yeah.
incarceration by 60%? And now you're saying, well, it doesn't work.
Well, and
I
I bet
mean,
if you went today and looked at the racial makeup of the jail at Rikers Island, it's probably the same racial makeup as it was in 2019 at the end of the year, because the
exactly.
racial, huh?
Exactly the same. I have looked
Yeah.
at
Wow. I mean, that's the best piece of evidence. We're doing everything you've done. It's the same thing was done in New Jersey. You did all these reforms in the name of racial inequity, and then you make them all, and then after the reforms, the racial makeup of the jail is the same.
And it will always be that way
Sure, because there.
because people. Every race doesn't commit crime at the same rate as every other race. Just look at it with women. I mean, 92% of the inmates at Rikers Island are men. Is that because the system is sexist? No, it's because men commit crimes at a higher rate than women. I mean, how do you explain that? And, you know,
You
to
explain it with science. You don't explain it with just talking points. I mean,
right.
when the Vera Institute comes in and says, "Oh, any bail reform we're going to make, any reform is going to carry with it a 40% failure to appear rate." I mean, a 40% failure to appear rate, in my mind, puts this criminal justice system close to collapse. If we can't get people to come to court, then our system is can't do its job. Well, Mr. Quinn, Jim, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Bell Post. I mean, I have looked forward to talking to you about this ever since I first heard you talking about recidivism rates, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly the way they're calculating it in Harris County. So I have appreciated it, and I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today.
I appreciate it. I really enjoyed it too. I love talking about this
Okay.
stuff.
Thank you for listening, and come back for the next episode of the Bell Post.